So today is May 2nd of 2010, and as I grab my Bible, I ask you to grab your Bible, and I put an outline on the back of your bulletin, and I'll confess to you what I confessed to my editorial staff, that I've been so excited about getting to do this study on James that I probably went a little overboard on the first one, and I'm going to try to back it down a little bit in the next lessons. But, you know, when I was a young kid learning to run track, they realized that I'm pretty fast once I get going, but it takes me a few steps to get going. So they'd make me run races that were beyond 100 yards. And the problem was it took me a while to realize that you can't run as fast as you can for a mile. You know, you got to pace yourself. You can't come out of the blocks running for all you're worth because you got to run a whole darn mile, you know. And I still have that general tendency of function that when I jump into these things, so I'll try to get a pace before we get to the end of summer. Anyway, today we're going to look at James chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. And if you want to be looking for that in your Bible as I talk for a minute, that'd be good because I'm going to read all of that. And then we're going to take it apart piece by piece. And I titled today's message, The Trials and Temptations of the Christian Life. And if I was going to try to give you an overview of the first chapter of James, I'd say that it's the general characteristics of Christ's life. As we look at experiencing the life of Christ in our lives, James does a miraculous job in five chapters of giving that. But the first chapter is a general characteristic. So here's the first question I have for you. What is the normal Christian life? What's the normal Christian life? When you take psychology courses, the first thing they teach you is there's no such thing as normal. Right, Marty? That's the very fundamental beginning of psychology. There's no normal. Your family is abnormal. See, no one doubts that. Right? And nobody's family is normal. I was a young Christian in college and one of the older kids in class, because I didn't get going that till after we lost the Vietnam War. And so I said, well, wasn't Jesus Christ's life normal? And the instructor was an atheist, and he said, someone who walks around and claims to be the Son of God and doesn't have a biological father, you think that's normal? Well, I hadn't really thought that one through. How about this one? What should you expect? What should we expect our Christian life to be like? Well, I mean, all of us have standards and expectations of life, right? How about this one? What do you tell people who are not believers their life will become like if they become believers in Jesus Christ? A lot of times, if you seriously look at that and you think about what you've heard other people say and maybe you've heard your own self say, it doesn't really line up with what we're going to read. So, can you see him? James chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. And that's my second set of bookmarks in here, which, in case you hadn't had time to find yours, now you do. Here's what the NIV Bible says. James 1, 1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you might be complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives graciously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave on the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from God. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. The brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position. But the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like the wild flower. And the sun rises, scorching the heat, withers the plant, it blossom falls, and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he is about his business. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when his own evil desires, he is dragged away and enticed. After the desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my brothers. Every good and perfect gift comes from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like the shifting shadow. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all that he created. That ends the reading. Now, let's take a look at this. Here's what the message says of James chapter 1, verse 1. I, James, am a slave of God and the Master Jesus, writing to the 12 tribes scattered throughout the kingdom. Hello. So, who's James? Now, is this the James of the disciples, where it was always Peter and James and John got to go do this stuff? Is that the James? No. This is Jesus' little brother. Jesus' younger brother. And while Jesus was alive, according to the accounts that we have, James didn't believe his brother was who he said he was. But after the resurrection from the dead, James became a believer. And quite a dominant and predominant believer. He was one of the heads of the Jewish Jerusalem church. Some of the commentaries I read said you could call him the pastor of the Jewish church in Jerusalem. And he was writing to the 12 tribes that were scattered. What happened is, after the stoning of Stephen, a lot of the Jews tucked and run from Jerusalem because it was a lethal thing to stay. Now, James had guts. He stayed. He was obviously known by people. Well, this is Jesus' brother. You know, I mean, he wasn't like just another face in the crowd. This is Jesus' brother here. But he stayed in Jerusalem. He was the head of the church. And best that we can tell, this was written before 50 A.D. It was written before the Jerusalem Council that took place in 50 A.D. So it's one of the earlier writings of the New Testament. And James is the author of that. So, the book of James, you could say it's a how-to book of Christian living. James' big thing is to help you and I not just say we're Christians, but live Christians. He wants you to be a doer, not just a sayer. When I was in church before I was a Christian, I saw a lot of people who would say and do one thing on Sunday, right? And then Monday through Saturday, live a totally different way. They call those people hypocrites. And James was writing to the Jewish believers so that they wouldn't be hypocrites, but they would genuinely be Christ followers. They would do, not just say. Here's what it says in James 1, 2 through 4 in the New Living Translation. Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. For you know when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. And there's three points that I'm going to draw from that. You may be able to see them. They're Red. Did it say if troubles come your way or when they come? It said when. The Christian life is not one that we should think is going to be troubleless and a sweet, smooth, rich, affluent sailing through life. Like there are churches today that present that. But it's not biblical. It's just a really good fantasy. And it's just positive self-talk. It's not biblical. It's not true. When troubles come. Yeah. When troubles come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. Is that how you respond to troubles? I have a friend that I used to get to work with all the time. And Dave, whenever we'd get into a real serious mess, he'd rub his hands together and he'd say, "Isn't this exciting? Isn't this exciting? We're going to get to see God do a miraculous thing." And we would enter into it with great joy. As I was visiting with Chris Brady last night, he says, "My mom, you know, in the midst of this life and death battle with cancer and the side effects of chemotherapy, she has great joy in her life. Whenever you talk to her, you walk away being encouraged." That's a testimony. Now, joy, is that a natural experience or spiritual? It's a spiritual gig. It's not happiness. Joy is altogether different. You girls who are doing Beth Moore's study with Julie, understand Beth has a great perspective on the fruit of the Spirit, joy. And you're getting some real good insights. And that's a promo to all the girls that are not involved in the Bible study. Get into it. It's some really good stuff. But joy is really a supernatural, spiritual experience. You know, when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So, is that what you know? Do you know when your faith is tested, that's actually growing endurance in your life, just like the corn in the fields and the bean in the fields and the lettuce and radishes in my garden? Is endurance a commodity that's easy to come by? If you want physical endurance, how do you get it? You got to train, don't you? You know, I have a friend who's training for a triathlon. And we have breakfast, and I'm thinking, man, you know, he does more in one of his workouts in the week than I do in the whole week of exercise. Well, why is he doing that? Why is he pushing himself so hard? Why is he riding 20 miles on a bicycle in a matter of minutes? To build endurance. It's the only way you get it. And, you know, I was in a gym yesterday. Dan and I were in a boxing gym. And we, you know, we had to weave a pop machine through these speed bags and these heavy bags and around all these weights. Now, why do boxers work a speed bag? Endurance. Why do you work the heavy bag? Endurance. And in order to work the heavy bag right, you got to have somebody holding it so it doesn't move around. You know, I jokingly punched one of them, and I idiotically thought, I wonder if I could still do a spin kick. And I thought, you haven't hurt yourself yet. Just remember what it used to be like, and don't try to do that now. Once upon a time, in another life, I used to work at endurance. And I used to beat on things so that my hands were hard, so when I beat on people, you know, that's the only way you get endurance is through testing and resistance. And it's the same way with faith. Faith works the same way as a physical. Now, is there anyone here who would like to be mature, complete, lacking in nothing? Anybody? Hee-hoo! Now then, how does Brother James say you're going to get there? Would you describe your life as A, I'm just surviving, or B, thriving? Now, you don't have to say that out loud, but take an honest appraisal of your life. In the midst of what's going on, in your life, in the challenges? Surviving? Just making it through the day? Or thriving, enjoying? So, let it grow when your endurance is fully developed. You will be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. What needs to change? Is it your situation or your thinking? When you're struggling with these things, do you need to just be taken out of the situation? Or do you need to think differently? See, in my life, I need to think differently. And many of you have heard me over the last year say, quote, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired," unquote. Heard me say that? Now, am I living before you the life that James challenged me to? Nope. I'm wanting my situation to change. What needs to change? My thinking. I started into it pretty good, but I got wore down, beat up, and somewhere along the line, lost it. I think I'm in the process of finding it. And it changes in my thinking. And I believe it's true for you the same way. It's not your situations that need to change. Doesn't matter whether it's financial, doesn't matter whether it's relational, doesn't matter whether it's physical, doesn't matter whether it's emotional. It's not your situation that needs to change, it's your thinking. Now here's what James writes to us in verse 5 through 8. If you need wisdom, ask our generous God, and He will give it to you. He will not rebuke you for asking. But when you ask Him, be sure your faith is in God alone. Don't waver, for the person who is divided in loyalty is unstable as a wave on the sea that blows and is tossed by the wind. Such people should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Their loyalty is divided between God and the world. They are unstable in everything they do. So I put a red word in there, but the first two sentences are one thought. And after the but, that whole rest of it is another thought. When we were learning how to study the Bible last year, I explained to you that in scriptural context, but is often something that brings contrasting ideas. As you're reading about Solomon in our Old Testament reading, and you read Solomon's Proverbs, the but means what comes before is different than what comes after. So, if you need wisdom, ask our generous God and He'll give it to you. It will be practical. It puts God's ideas into action. When you read this morning of Solomon's great decision, he's got two hookers that come to him. One of them with a dead baby and one of them with a live baby. And the ladies explain, we both are hookers, we're prostitutes, and we both have children born within 3 days of each other. And the other night when we were sleeping, this lady rolled over and killed her baby and snuck over to me and stuck the dead baby next to my breast and took my live baby. And so they're before Solomon and they're arguing over whose kid this is. And Solomon listens to him for a while and he says, okay, enough. Bring me a sword. And they bring him a sword and he says, okay, now take it and cut that one in half. Give half to her and half to her and that'll just end the dispute. And the mother says, no, no, don't kill it. Don't kill it. I'd rather have it grow up with her than be dead. And the other lady says, yeah, cut it in half. Give me half and give her half. You know what Solomon says? Give the baby to the mama who said, don't kill it. That's the real mama. See, that's wisdom that's put into practical application. When you ask God for wisdom, it won't be pie in the sky, by and by, someday stuff. It'll be practical and applicable. God's wisdom gets beyond common sense. When you look at God's wisdom, it's different. Wisdom, when you're asking for this type of wisdom, what you're really asking is to be like Jesus Christ. For years gone by, there was people wore wristbands, WWJD. Remember those? WWJD. What would Jesus do? What we're asking is not to figure out what he would do and then do it. We're asking his Holy Spirit to actually do it through us when we're asking for this type of wisdom. Is there anyone here who would like the ability to make wise decisions in difficult circumstances? Anybody? You know, I happen to be in one of those situations where I got to make some real difficult decisions. And so I'm asking God for wisdom. What does Brother James say we need to do to get there? Would you describe your faith as single-minded or double-minded? How would you do that? Marty and the worship team led us through a song this morning that said we would ask like a child. Right? As you hear the little one in the back, you know, when you're that age, and when she asks grandma for a snack, do you think she's double-minded? When my one-year-old grandson is at my house and he comes to me with a box of Triscuit in one hand and a Tupperware dish in the other hand, and he's saying, please, please. He can't say poppy yet, but he can say please. That's his version of please. What is he saying? Would you take some of this out of the box and put it into my container because I want a snack? Now, is he thinking when he comes that Poppy's going to say, no? He actually comes to Poppy because he knows Poppy's the yes man. Right? Now, your Heavenly Father is the yes man, just like the Poppy. But you can't come to it double-minded. You got to come like a child, believing he's going to give you what's best. Now, if it's just a couple minutes before we're going to eat, does Poppy say yes? No. No, he doesn't. He takes Nathan into the kitchen, shows him how to put the stuff back that he got out, picks him up, and shows him what Grandma and his mom and Deb are cooking, right? And sells him on the idea that what they're making is better than what he had in mind. And it's easy sell job, right? Help Poppy do this. Oh, yeah. Let's have a little taste. Cook's got to taste the stuff, you know, right? But that's the way you need to come to God, not double-minded, not hedging your bets. We have a number of people that we're praying for as a congregation who are in medical care. You trust God to work through the medical system. Does that make sense? You're not trusting the medical system and how smart the doctors are and how great the drugs are and all that stuff. You're trusting God to lead you through the path, but you're not putting your faith and trust in the system. You're putting it in God, and you're trusting Him to lead and guide you through, and you're asking for wisdom as you go through it. Does that make sense? Okay. So what needs to change in our situations here? Is it our situation or our thinking? It's your thinking. You have to change to think biblical, to think James-like, to think Jesus-like, to think God-like. So you don't need your situation to change. You need to... Now, if your loyalty is divided between God and the world, should you expect... What should you expect when you ask God for stuff? Don't expect to get it if you're double-minded. Is this true? If their loyalty is divided between God and the world, then they are unstable in everything they do. Is this true? If my loyalty is divided between God and the world, then I will be unstable in everything I do. Is that true? The if and the then I put into there, all the red stuff that's in there, I added to what the Bible actually said. But is that true? I mean, if then is a way of logic, of looking at this logically. If I'm double-minded, I will be unstable in everything I do. When I'm confused, what's the problem? Double-minded. I'm not single-minded. I'm not God-focused. Is there a change that needs to take place in the way you think or are thinking? If you're double-minded, is it a test of trust? I think when you're double-minded, you'll find this to be true. You're trusting in something, someone other than God. Here's what it says in James 9 through 11, chapter 1, 9 through 11. A brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position. But the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like the wildflower, and the sun rises and the scorching heat withers and the plant. Its blossom falls and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he's about his business. Now, the but in there is, again, you've got one sentence and then you got a whole slug of sentences after that. Is that a change from the way our culture is thinking? Is a culture thinking that those of us who are poor are really the best off? Is that? No. What are they saying? You want to work at being rich. You want to work at being someone who accumulates a lot of things, right? When you accumulate all these things, you got to add air to the tires, and you got to, you know, you got to get the boat out of storage and get it ready for the season, right? The more stuff you got, anyway, it's a different. Based on this passage, is it best to be poor or to work at being rich? Based on that passage, I think biblically, it's better to be content with what you have. Be thankful for the job you have, but don't put your trust into the job. Don't put your trust into money. I have friends who were telling me the other day they were so pleased that they had this money stashed away in the bank. And I thought, do you realize that that's just all fake? I mean, none of that money really has an asset behind it anymore. All the gold's gone. Every grain of sand in the United States of America is leveraged to some people in China. And they can call in the debt anytime they want. Do you realize that that money in the bank that you're trusting isn't worth anything? All that stuff you've been trying to accumulate? Now, well, let's look at money from God's point of view. Is money a big deal to God? He owns it all. No big deal to him. What is it God values most? See, God's not interested. He's interested in what lasts. He's interested in our souls. Not temporary things like money and possessions. Right? You buy a possession and in a short period of time you've got to either fix it or replace it. It's just temporary stuff. Even our body. Just a temporary gig. What's important is our souls. So we need to adjust our thinking, adjust our lives so that our souls are right with God. Here's what it says in verses 12 through 15. God blesses those who patiently endure testing and temptation. Afterwards, they'll receive a crown of life that God has promised those who love Him. And remember, when you're being tempted, do not say, God is tempting me. God never is tempted to do wrong. He never tempts anybody else. Temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us, drag us away. These desires give birth to sinful actions, and when sin is allowed to grow, it gives birth to death. So, testing and temptations, what are they good for? When I wrote that, I was singing the old 1970 songs. War. What is it good for? Nothing. Absolutely not. And that's what most people think about trials and temptations. They're not good for anything. But does God bless those who patiently endure through testing and temptation? Yeah. What are they good for? They're good for blessings if you respond to them correctly and don't react after your flesh. Can you see Him? God does not tempt. God does test. Is there a difference between tempting and testing? Oh, yeah, totally deal, different deal. God never tempts anybody, but He does test them. Problems, problems, problems. Why do we have problems? because of our decisions, number one. We have effects in our life because of decisions we've made. It's not a temptation deal. It's sin has actually come to life and has caused death because of decisions we made. We have problems to mature us, and we have some problems, and this is a small list, just simply to glorify God. That's why we have them. Jesus was walking down the street one day, and they said, well, why is this guy here born blind? And he says, well, he was born that way simply so God could be glorified today. And he gave him back his sight. Or was he lame? I don't know. It's John 6 or 8. Anyway, those are few in your life. How about this one? And remember when you're being tempted. Do not say, God has tempted me. God is never tempted to do wrong, and he never tempts anyone else. So does it say if you're tempted or when? When you're tempted. You're going to be tempted in the Christian life. You will not get beyond temptation. You guys have had a pastor in the past who said, I never sin and I'm never tempted to sin. You don't got one of those guys now. I know when. When is a frequent flyer in my life? You know? I know when I'm tempted. But I'm learning how to respond after the Spirit rather than react after the flesh. I had a real colorful illustration, but I'm not going to tell you that one today. Temptations, where do they come from? If they don't come from God, where do they come from? Can you see them? Does God allow Satan to tempt people? Yeah, he does allow Satan to tempt people, and he allows him a very small playbook. He's not unlimited in the ways that he can tempt you. They're all in biblical patterns. He only has so many plays to run. If he was a pitcher, he's only got so many pitches. Right? And all you need to do is learn when he's going to throw which pitch and you can hit it. So, temptation wants to seduce you into sin, and that leads to death. So, can you see him? This testing is to refine your faith and deepen your what? Dependency on Christ. Don't trust yourself. Don't trust the flesh. Don't trust your money. Don't trust your schemes and resources and assets. Depend upon Christ. That's what it's all about in the testing and the temptation, is to become more dependent on Christ. So, who knows how to play the blame game? Anybody? It's the other person's fault. I did not have any trouble coming up with each one of these. I couldn't help it. I didn't have any trouble thinking of that. Everybody's doing it. Marty and I were talking about prom. I remember when my children wanted to go to Sterling High School prom, they said, everybody's doing it. Well, then obviously you shouldn't. It's just a mistake. That's a good one, huh? Nobody's perfect. Use that one last week? Well, might be a good one for this week. The devil made me do it. Flip Whistling made a lot of money on that one, and it became a cultural catchphrase for a while. I was pressured into it, dot, dot, dot. It goes on and on. Where did the blame game start? Garden of Eden. Right after sin entered, blame. It's the woman you gave me. What's he really saying? God, my life was really good until you screwed it all up and you brought this woman in. If you wouldn't have made this naked woman, I wouldn't be in this mess right now. Right? Now, understand that when you start playing the blame game, it's just on the other side of sin. That makes sense? You've already stepped over the line, and it's time to step back. In Matthew 4, 1 through 11, how was Jesus tempted? Food. Right? Risk. This morning, I had all of my stuff loaded into the magic bus except my cup of coffee, And I walked by my motorcycle and I thought, why am I taking a four-wheeler? I could take a two-wheeler. So I went in, got my cup of coffee, told my wife, I said, I'm going to ride my bike. Packed everything into the bike. Got it all locked up. Was putting on my coat, gloves, and I thought, to wear your helmet? I'm not going to wear my helmet today. Now, anybody who rides a motorcycle knows that you're going to crash. You're going to crash. And it only takes one time, seeing somebody crash, and what happens to your skull, it looks like Halloween when you're smashing pumpkins, to realize that riding a motorcycle without a helmet is taking a risk. But this morning, I decided I would rather have the wind blow through what hair I have left and risk it. Now, where did that come from, God? 90-some percent of the time, I ride my motorcycle with a helmet and with a face shield. Because I've seen what happens if you don't. Today, I risked it. That's tempting God, isn't it? I shouldn't do that. I'm on my way here before I think through that. I think, that was not the best of ideas, Wilmer. Stuff. That's how God was tempted. He, Satan, took Jesus and showed him all the stuff in the world. He said, Adam gave it to me, I'll give it all to you. You'll be richer than Solomon, who was a really rich guy. Things. That's the way you'll be tempted. Food, risk, stuff, things. You'll make things your idol. You'll make adrenaline, risk, adventure. I've never met anybody who I was counseling and trying to help them with an affair that wasn't first enticed and excited by the risk of it. I'd risk everything for him or her. Right? Talking with Chris Brady last night, one of their pastors risked it all to run off with the church secretary. Ruined the church, ruined a lot of people's faith. What was the temptation? Food? Nah, I'm not even going to go into food. We'll go into food when we get done here. Right? Stuff? Do you see it? That's the way it goes. What does 1 Corinthians 10:13 say to encourage us? Here's what it says. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, He will provide a way out so that you can stand against it. When you are tempted, there is a way of escape. You just have to choose it. You have to change the way you're thinking. So, temptation comes when your own desires, which entice you, drag you away, and these desires to give birth to sinful actions, and when sin is allowed to grow, it gives birth to death. Temptation. What are we to do? Nip it! Nip it! Nip it in the bud! That's my best Barney Fife imitation. There's actually a Bible study based on that old TV series. Mayberry RFD. And there's a whole lesson on temptation. And it's all based on Barney Fife. Andy, you got nip it, nip it, nip it in the bud. And that's true. That's what you need to do. As soon as you notice that it's there, you know, as soon as that weed's big enough to get a hold of it, pull it out of the garden. Don't let it grow until it goes to seed. Now, can we resist temptation? Sure. We resist temptation by turning to God for strength and choosing to obey His word. But you got to turn. You got to turn the channel in your head. You've got to turn your attention away from what you're looking at, what you're thinking on. The girls around breakfast table, they were teasing me about one of my fantasies. Last year when I was in chemotherapy and it was in my insane period of time, one morning Julie came in and I had this yellow sheet of paper that I had written on. I said, now you got to call Lisa and you got to talk to Lisa about this archaeological expedition that we were supposed to go on. I'm too sick. I'm not going to be able to make it. I'm not going to be able to get there. And so you know, and I was 100% serious. 100%. And the nurse was standing there and she says, I didn't know your husband was involved in archaeological expeditions. And my wife's standing there like, I didn't know that either. And, you know, but I was dead serious. And Julie finally took the yellow page and looked at all my notes that I had made when I was up all night, strung out on these weird psychological things and drugs and effects and everything. And she says, so you want me to call Lisa? Here's her number. And you want me to make sure that she gets those things done for you because you can't do them because you're in the hospital. And when you get out of the hospital, then you'll work with her on these other things. Yeah. And they were making fun of me this morning at breakfast. And Debbie Case was sitting there having breakfast. She says, you know Lisa? Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's African-American. What? You have an African-American assistant that works with you in archaeological expeditions? Yeah. Are you crazy? Yeah. Don't tell people in church that we talked about this. So I did it anyway. But, you know, and I said, it's not really difficult. I watched these Tomb Raider movies where Angelina Jolie and this guy with two 45s. I said, I have a 40. Howard will know this. I have a Smith & Wesson 45 under this arm and a Smith & Wesson 357 under this arm. And I have a sawed-off shotgun. And in my fantasy, I go on these archaeological expeditions with Lisa. And I said, it's totally a business deal. She's really hot, but it's not a sexual thing. It's just a business thing. You know, but we do these things in my fantasies. But you have to turn from those. See, you can't really live there. Now, maybe you guys don't have those fantasies that when you're driving pointlessly and you don't want to listen to the radio, you just daydream. I do. Now, but you got to turn from that stuff. You can't live there. It's just a thought. It's just imagination. It's just insanity. But periodically, I can do that. And I've got other ones that I won't tell you. What does Hebrews 5:15 say to encourage us? It's better than what I just told you. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but we have one who is tempted in every way, just as we are, yet without sin. See, Jesus Christ was tempted to sin in every way that you and I are. Money, possessions, food. I bet when we get to heaven, Mary Magdalene is hot. You know? The women who he helped out of prostitution are amazingly beautiful. Outstandingly beautiful. Every way that you've been tempted, cheat, lie, steal, fantasize, whatever temptation it is, He understands. He was tempted to do them all, and he never did. And you're saying, well, how could he do them all? Because he's God. He can multitask in ways that you and I can't. So he's been tempted in every way you and I are. Yet, when we take communion, we're reminded that he never did sin. And that very life is available for you and I. How do you get that? Testings, trials, temptations, problems. That's how we get there by that. Here's the last segment, and I'll wrap this up. Don't be deceived, my brothers, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give birth through the word of truth, give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits to all he created. So, if it says, do not be deceived, then are we? What are some of the deceptions of the world and the devil that have exposed to you this morning? Just today. If you live the Christian life, it's going to be hunky-dory, sweet, glorious. Money, wealth, affluence, Everything's going to go your way because you just become born again. If you get saved, everything in your life's going to get better. I've heard evangelists say that. And I said, have you read the whole book? You know, God loves us so much, He doesn't let us live that way. Money. Work at making money and acquiring it and hoarding it and stuff. Is that one of your deceptions? Endurance. Faith. Well, I can have one foot in the world, one foot in the kingdom, and I can ask God for whatever I want because He's my dad and He spoils me rotten. He'll give me whatever I want. No. No, you can't. You can't be double-minded. You can't trust the world and its system and God and His system and expect Him to answer your prayers. You got to be like a little kid. Isn't it fun when they're two, before they understand all the deceptions in the games? By the time they get to be six, they already know the toys and they know the blame game. And aren't they fun when they're little like that? That's the way you and I are supposed to live as believers. Would this be godly thinking? Romans 8:28. We know that apart from all things, God works good to those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. In spite of all this stuff. No, it's in it. We know that in all these things of life, God works the good for those of us who love Him and those who have been called according to His purpose. It's in the crisis situations with my bone cancer. It's in the crisis situations financially that many of us in our community and country are experiencing. It's in those things that He accomplishes as a purpose, not when He takes you out of them. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth that we might be a kind of first fruit of all He created. Jesus offers new birth. He offers to save you. Have you received the new life? That's the biggest decision any of you can make. If you haven't bought into it 100%, not a little bit, not I'm toying with it, not... The only way you can get saved is through this gift from the Father of Heavens. When you see those beautiful stars tonight, that glorious moon that He had last week, when you see that the Father of Lights made all of those, He wants you to experience eternity with Him. But you got to receive the new birth. So, can you see Him? What do you need to change to show Him more? And will you do that today?